Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Davida Goldberg. We have with us today Bruno Schawatz, professor of French at the University of Minnesota, and we'll be talking about his recent book, Is Theory Good for the Jews? Bruno, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get right into it. Can I ask you to tell us about the title of your book, Is Theory Good for the Jews? Is that a genuine question? And does your book offer an answer?
Well, you probably have got the irony of the title. So it's obviously, you know, tongue-in-cheek and provocative. It's also a wink at some accusations of Jewish tribalism. But part of asking this question for me was to embrace, in a way, Jewish particularism, but with a grain of salt. I was reminded recently of a wonderful essay by Levinas entitled Judaism and Revolution. And in that essay, Levinas says that there exists such a thing as a particularism beyond universalism. It's quite an enigmatic, but it's also a very profound thought about the Jewish factualness or facticity. So maybe there is something in Jewish particularism that revolutionary universalism has never been able to grasp, and in a way it's what my book to a certain extent is all about.
So does that in the end then, do you answer, is theory good for the Jews? Is that an answer?
So I don't really answer the question, but I argue throughout the book that the postmodern engagement with the Jews has not been particularly helpful for responding to the new challenges and to the new anti-Semitism. Not at any moment in the book, I assume you've seen that, do I imply or insinuate that there is anything anti-Semitic in postmodern theory? Far from it. I actually think that there is extremely useful text, especially by Jean-François Lyotard, that allows us to understand anti-Semitism from a metaphysical perspective, which I find extremely useful. Now, remember that Lyotard or Blanchot in particular did not belong to the revolutionary left universalism. They were on a certain kind of left, but not to the universalistic type of revolutionary left. So what we see today with people like philosophers like Vatimo or Alain Badiou is, I would argue, and I argue in the book, is a shift of paradigm. We are moving from a sort of idealization of Jewish particularism and the sort of special mission of the Jews. Unfortunately, generally it's reductive and it reduces the Jews to a sort of exile and diasporism. But we're seeing now a shift to a return to the Jewish problem that the left, since the 19th century, I would argue, has confronted. So what I mean is that Jewish particularism is seen again by the likes of Badiou and Vatimo in particular, even Enzo Traverso, as an obstacle on the path to progress and revolution. However, I would say that, you know, more recently, Jean-Luc Nancy has offering us, and Jean-Luc Nancy is, as you know, an heir, one of the last actually voice that comes from Derrida and from deconstruction. And he has just offered a very intriguing theory of anti-Semitism. And so people who come from the background of deconstruction, thinking of Nancy and thinking also of Jacob Rogozinski, they are even tackling now the new forms of anti-Semitism, and especially even the Islamic anti-Semitism, which I think is frankly unprecedented move, and it's very good news in terms of awareness of these new challenges, even within the realm of so-called postmodern or deconstructive theory. So that's how I would answer. There is, of course, as you know, that things are changing now. You know, I'm talking to you from Israel in a very, very complicated and very scary circumstance and situation. And so we see now resurgence of right-wing populism and anti-Semitism. And it's an extremely complicated phenomenon because this movement is also pro-Israel and is currently dividing American Jewry. So the book, in a way, would have to take into account this new phenomenon. But obviously, I wrote it before all of this happened.
Right. It's amazing. The book seems to kind of capture a moment in time, and these things are shifting so much. So you were concerned in the book to make a distinction, I think, between something that was, you could maybe broadly say, is an old form of anti-Semitism, which is more of that nationalist, white nationalist and national chauvinist hatred of Jews, where Jews become the target of that, versus a new form of anti-Semitism. And yet so much changes so quickly. That's quite interesting that you are now saying that some of the targets of your book's interest and critique, the theorists who seem to be ignoring some of the different strands of anti-Semitism, even that is changing. So you mentioned Nancy.
Oh, yes. Yes. But, you know, at the same time, I'd say that anti-Semitism is never really new. The tropes are always the same. You always have an element of plot, of conspiracy, of Jewish lies, of Jewish invented the Holocaust, and so on and so forth. But one thing that can be said that I would argue is that after the World War II, anti-Semitism could no longer, in certain circles at least, and in Europe in particular, but also in the U.S., could not really be explicit. In fact, Maurice Blanchot, I was reading a text by Maurice Blanchot. It's actually a letter that Blanchot wrote to Emmanuel Levinas in 1968. You know, we are in May 68, so everybody is commemorating May 68 now. So I was reading a letter that Blanchot wrote to Levinas in order to explain why he suddenly or brutally, abruptly quit the movement of May 68. And he explained to Levinas that there is now, that is in May 68 or in 67, 68, in the 60s, there is now, he said, I quote him, an anti-Semitism without anti-Semites. That's a very bizarre formula, but you know that Blanchot was always very cryptic and enigmatic. What that means, I think, is that the left of the 1960s was being ignorant of the meaning of Judaism, the meaning of the State of Israel, was becoming some kind of objective ally or accomplice to those who want to destroy Israel and the Jews. That's basically what he said to Levinas in his letter. Now, of course, if you add the Muslim element due to immigration much later, that is since the 1990s or 2000s, then what is new is the old, if you will, Muslim anti-Semitism, which is grafted on the old European anti-Semitism and Christian anti-Judaism, and above that, the revolutionary left anti-Judaism. So all that makes a sort of explosive cocktail. But you see, at the same time, the grammar of anti-Semitism remains always pretty much the same. That is conspiracy, invention, lies, plot, powerfulness, all omnipotence of the Jews, and so on and so forth.
So that's interesting. One of the things that you bring forward in your book is an event that, you know, as an English language scholar, I didn't know much about, but it seems to have been famous in France, which is the Camus affair. And you seem to argue there that there was a lot of attention paid to the Camus affair because it's a certain kind of anti-Semitism with anti-Semitism, you might say. So maybe you could just tell us what the Camus affair is and how it played out.
So Renaud Camus is or was a very confidential writer until the so-called affair Renaud Camus. He wrote for a bunch of aficionados, around, I would say, 2,000 or 3,000 readers. And he started as a sort of avant-garde writer. He was very close to Roland Barthes, actually, and very much on the left. And then he moved gradually toward the right wing. So he was accustomed, I think he has stopped a long time ago now, but he was accustomed to write and to publish his diary every year, and one installment of his diary. In this diary, he was recording pretty much every event or incident of his daily life, which was very tedious, actually, and boring to read, unless you really loved Renaud Camus and was part of this group of aficionados. So in his diary, in 2000, he published an installment of his diary in which he says that Jews, and here I'm summing up, I'm not quoting, right, that Jews in general have a hard time relating in an experiential, in an organic way to French literature and culture. So you see, this is, I would say, typically the anti-Semite, as described by Sartre in his Reflection, his Anti-Semite and Jew. That is, it's the really old type of the French elitist literary anti-Semitism. It's obviously not lethal. It's obviously not murderous. It's instead, I would say, it's a sort of salon anti-Semitism, a chic anti-Semitism. But it was also, and that's why I took, in a way, I defended Renaud Camus, actually, at the time of the affair Renaud Camus, but also a little bit in my book, without denying his old type of anti-Semitism, of literary anti-Semitism. It was also because I think it was also a distraction in 2000 from what was becoming very serious, what was going on at the time, that is real attacks on real Jews and synagogues during the Second Intifada.
Yeah, so are you really saying that you are defending Camus, or you're just saying that you felt it was the wrong conversation?
I thought it was the wrong conversation. When there was the affair Renaud Camus, about at the same time, Elisabeth Roudinesco, the historian of psychoanalysis, together with Jacques Derrida, published a book entitled What About Tomorrow? In French, of course, it's untranslatable into English. It's De Quoi Demain? What of Tomorrow? And in that book, there is a whole chapter about the anti-Semitism that is coming, or the anti-Semitism of the future, or the anti-Semitism to come. And what is very, very strange and disconcerting when I found out, when I read that book, it was a very long time ago, it was, 16 years ago or so, is that the conversation is entirely limited to this old literary type of anti-Semitism, and they take Renaud Camus as a sort of emblem of the most dangerous and the most lethal type of anti-Semitism. And so I was really shocked to see that and to not see one word about what was going on with real Jews, with synagogues, and with the anti-Semitism that was going to become gradually more and more violent in France at the time.
Mm-hmm. So is there then a distinction that you can make between an old version, even though you've said that, you know, there are certain tropes that are kind of perennial, is there a distinction that's important to make between an old version of anti-Semitism and a new version and a new anti-Semitism? Something that we would want to call a new anti-Semitism?
Well, I have the impression that the old anti-Semitism is pretty much fading away, except in certain quarters, in certain circles of the extreme far right in the United States, but also in Europe. But I think that Pierre-André Taguieff, the historian of racism, has really summed up the problem very well back in 2000 when he was writing his classic book entitled The New Judeophobia, was translated into English as The New Judeophobia. And he says there is a sort of paradigm shift between this old type of anti-Semitism, in which Jews were seen as a sort of quote-unquote dirty race. And now what we have is Jews being seen as the dirty racist. And here it's actually a quotation from Alain Finkielkraut, who has a very good sense of formula and a very good rhetorical sense. And I think there was something true and something very well observed in this assessment. The racist anti-Semitism is no longer something that you see very much. It doesn't mean that it's not still racist, but it's another kind of phobia, I would say. And it's, in a way, it's a return to this very, very old Christian idea that Jews are the enemy of the enemies of mankind, right? So it makes, in today's vocabulary, enemy of mankind, of humankind, is basically racist or fascist or colonialist and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, we probably could talk more about that because of, you know, as we mentioned before, things are changing so quickly. And now there's governments in Poland and Hungary and resurgent larger and larger voices in America that really seem to maybe be making that form of anti-Semitism newly relevant. But I do want to talk more about what you've mentioned that is new to me, which is some of the iterations of what we may call the new anti-Semitism that have come up in French letters, such as Stefan Hessel's manifesto. You call it a manifesto. It's just titled Time for Outrage. And I wonder if you can kind of help us understand what that was and maybe how it kind of compares to Renaud Camus and its reception.
So first of all, I think it's really crucial to say that Stefan Hessel was a hero of the resistance and he had Jewish ancestry. So obviously he cannot, and I did not do that in my hope, I did not do that in the book, be suspected of anti-Semitism. However, I'd say that he affects something which is very problematic, which is a sort of dubious inversion in this very short 16-page manifesto that had an extraordinarily huge impact and sold by the millions in many languages. Stefan Hessel argues that the Palestinians have now become the résistants, you know, using the vocabulary of the collaboration and Vichy France and the occupation of France by the Nazis. So the Palestinians have become the résistants, the Israelis are the new Nazis. And he also argues in this pamphlet that the Hamas is a movement of revolution against oppression. So I would say that those readings, if you will, are fueling, because they are extremely hyperbolic, they are fueling this new anti-Semitism. Because indeed, if Israelis are the new Nazis, then why would the Jews complain about the Holocaust, since they are capable of doing exactly the same thing? So, I'm now in Israel. I've been in Israel for 3 months now, and you don't even need to go to American or European campuses to hear this dubious, very problematic analogy between Zionism and National Socialism. In fact, there are Israeli Jews, Heideggerian or post-Heideggerian scholars who recycle this trope, which is a main trope of the new anti-Semitism that had actually been already debunked by Leon Poliakov in the 1960s after the Six-Day War, and also by Raymond Aron, and even by Levinas a very long time ago, even before the Six-Day War.
So, tell us again, what is that trope? What is the trope that has been debunked?
So, what has been debunked is that the Jews, with the creation of the foundation of Israel, were becoming the oppressor, and therefore, by becoming the oppressor, they were to an extent, approving their or demonstrating or embodying their evil nature. right? And this idea that Jews have this evil nature is one step away, of course, from explaining the persecutions of the war and explaining the thousands of years of persecutions of the Jews as the again as the enemy of humankind.
So it's kind of like a post hoc justification of those thousands of years, because look, you know, we see they in fact are the oppressors. The conspiracy has come out of the closet. Is that something you would?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But it also, I think, has to do with something you mentioned in the book, which is kind of a Christian idea that somehow underlies implicitly a lot of postmodern theory, which is the Paulian idea of the Jew as a spirit, as the Jew in spirit versus the Jew in flesh. So, for example, Israel is the Jew in flesh, the actual community of Jews, you know, asking for self-determination. But the kind of postmodern ethic is a spiritual Jew, the Jew in, and which is, you know, you say it's interestingly related to the old Christian Paulian idea that Jews are acceptable as a spiritual but not a real group.
So here I would make a distinction, which I think is very important. It's the distinction between I don't like to use the word postmodern, although I use it in the book all the time because I have to simplify, since the book is also a sort of intellectual history. But I would say that someone like Lyotard or even Blanchot had really, and of course Derrida, had really understood that the problem that Paulinism or the Pauline paradigm or matrix, if you will, poses for the Jews. For example, Lyotard in the late 80s or very early 90s, he wrote a book, a sort of contra Saint Paul, so to speak, in which he says that Saint Paul that there is a symbolic and an actual violence in the dialectic of Paulinism, of erasing, if you will, or overcoming the Jew in the Jew of the flesh, and spiritualizing the Jew and saying the Christian is the new Jew or the new Israelite. So I would say that thinkers like Blanchot, obviously Levinas, I don't need to mention, but Blanchot and Lyotard have never fallen into that trap of a sort of neo-Paulinism. However, this is the case. I see it as a case that is coming up now, more recently with Alain Badiou in particular. Alain Badiou having written a book on St. Paul, a strange celebration of St. Paul as the founder of Universalism, and at the same time, condemnation of the Jew in the flesh in a book entitled Meanings of the Word Jew, in which he says that basically the sort of the accomplished, the authentic Jew is the Jew here who has given up all kind of particularism. And he goes back to St. Paul for that. So I find it I think it's very important to distinguish between this school of thought, if there is such a thing, as the sequence that would go from 1960 to the 1980s, and then what comes after that, which is a sort of return to the Pauline. Now, of course, the case of someone like a thinker like Judith Butler is also a very interesting case that we can broach a little bit later, if you'd like.
Yeah, I would like to get back to Butler, but I just want to stop for a second at this idea of the universalist versus the particularist, because it seems to me like that's been a paradox of modern morality from like the beginning of the Enlightenment, and there's there are good, wonderful theories that kind of bring us to a more universalist ethic, and others that bring us to more particularist ethic, and the Jew gets kind of caught in the middle and becomes the trope of either side.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So, yeah.
Absolutely.
So you have the Jew as the universalist, the cosmopolitan, and that doesn't look so great. And then you have the Jew as the foreigner, the tribalist, the person who is for themselves, the person who asks the question, is theory good for the Jews? That's the kind of the particularist Jew that also doesn't look so good, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is what I called, following Zygmunt Bauman, the Jews as the prismatic category. That the Jew is always seen through the prism of a certain ideology, which is, for example, anti-internationalist, or which is, on the other hand, revolutionary internationalist, and the Jew is always at odds from those two perspectives, if you will.
Yeah, one of my more recent interviews was with an author named Chad Allen Goldberg, and he wrote about modernity and the Jews. And he had a great phrase that he borrowed from Claude Levi-Strauss, that Jews are just good to think with. And it could be that because we're kind of, you know, Jews are kind of other, but near other. You know, they're not other enough to be, you know, to be a race distinct, especially in today's viewpoint.
Yeah, I didn't know that phrase by Levi-Strauss. All I can say is that Levi-Strauss is missing in my genealogy, and it's for one reason, is that Levi-Strauss never, to my knowledge at least, really engaged with the Jewish as trope or as figure, which is quite interesting actually. And Bataille either. Which is also interesting. There are two, and I would add Foucault as well. So I would say those three thinkers have never really engaged in the same way as, you know, Blanchot and of course Derrida and
you think like that there that as much as Jews have been good to think with and in a way that is actually troubling for the Jews, there's something that's a gap when Foucault comes to Paris for his first, you know, years at the, you know, in college, and he does not, in 1944 is when he arrives, and he never then addresses the Holocaust. And it's an interesting gap. Those three thinkers are kind of the gap is glaring in those three thinkers that you mentioned. So you also, we were just talking about the kind of the ideologies that might kind of underlie some of the more recent understandings of ethics, whether it's, you know, the kind of dialectic or a paradox between universalism and particularism. And some of those things are the tropes that are underlying Stefan Hessel's Time for Outrage. Some of the things that characterize those ethics are the character of the nomad, the transgressor, or the alien to society, which have been put in as a kind of ethical high ground by these earlier figures that you just mentioned, like Bataille. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how those tropes that we see even in Hessel can find genealogy in much earlier figures such as Bataille and what that ethics, the ethics of nomadism, I might say, did in that earlier context, first of all.
So, you know, if I were to sum up Bataille's worldview, I would say that it's a cosmo-economic worldview. In other words, in the universe, for Bataille, there is too much energy. And it all comes from the sun, right? This energy, there's an excedent of solar energy, and this excedent is used for play and for waste. So inherently, cosmically and ontologically, human beings must use this excess of energy by wasting. And we have art, the birth of art, of culture, the building of pyramids, cathedrals, or you have destruction. So evil for Bataille is part of a cosmic condition. It's as simple as that. There is no way out of this. And Bataille thinks that we should embrace evil and, you know, rather than do war, we should create art and culture and some sort of sacrificial shelters, so to speak. But there will always be destruction. Now, in my book, I argue that the radical social critique, on the other hand, seems to believe in purification, seems to believe that it's possible one day to do away completely with evil and with negativity. So you see how alien to Georges Bataille's worldview it is. Right. For radical social critique, violence is always a response to oppression. And once oppression is overcome and eradicated, well, then negativity, evil, violence will be eradicated. It's almost a Rousseauist type of a scheme or paradigm, if you will. You know that that man is born free and he is an innocent and he is everywhere unchained, right? So you have to fight this oppression, and then you will have some kind of paradise recovered. Right. So that's what I've called in my book the moralistic turn.
Mm-hmm. Well, what struck me a lot about that is that it seems like an ironic and interesting turnaround, because they're taking the tropes of theory, the amoralistic kind of poetry, the interest and elevation of the idea of evil, which for Bataille is in art, and subversion and transgression is in writing. And they take these same kind of language and structures and ideological structures, and they take what was an amoralism, and you argue turn it into a moralism.
Yes. I used the example as an illustration of an interesting Algerian Francophone writer whose name is Salim Bashi, who has written lots of novels. But among those novels, he wrote several what I would call terrorist novels. That is, novels in which the narrator is a terrorist, or in which the narrator puts himself in the mind of a terrorist, or the main character, protagonist, terrorist, and so on. So I think he does a remarkable job at entering into the mind of a terrorist, jihadist particularly. But nonetheless, he reads Islamic nihilism and violence as a response to oppression and victimization, instead of a case of radical evil. And so he justifies his fascination for the terrorist, which is a fascination that goes back to fascination for evil that you have in Baudelaire, that you have in Bataille, that you already had in the Marquis de Sade, of course, in the French tradition, or L'Otréamont and poets of the 19th century. But he uses it to justify to build a sort of social critique, which those names that I mentioned never did. So if you compare with Jean Genet, who is another poet of evil, if you will, in the 1980s...
Yeah, the English language audience may not know Jean Genet, but he was very well known.
Jean Genet was a very well-known author who has been discovered by Jean-Paul Sartre, who spent some times in jails because he was a little thief, and at least it's the legend of Jean Genet, he's the thief.
That was in the 1920s, I suppose.
So that he wrote in the 1940s, 50s, and he stopped writing novels. He wrote lots of theater, but once Sartre had buried him under an 800-page biography, he just couldn't write anymore. So Sartre wrote an enormous biography of Jean Genet when Genet was, of course, just at the beginning of his literary and novelistic production, which is a poisoned gift, if you will. But Genet, in the 1980s, his last book, if I am correct, it's a big novel about the Palestinian Revolution, in which Genet embraces the Palestinian cause. But he is very clear that he embraces the Palestinian cause out of love for evil, and of love for a transgression, if you will, a fascination for transgression, for all forms of perversion, and also out of an anxiety in front of the good. So for Genet, if you will, the Jews had to be killed because they embody the good, because they embody the law, they embody God, and not because they were fantasized as the oppressors of Muslims and Palestinians. So I think it's very, very important to understand that shift. If you read Salim Bashi, you have elements of Jean Genet in this sort of fascination, you know, for transgression. But what you have is a form of social critique that justifies violence out of a sense of reestablishing the good and reestablishing a certain kind of justice, which is the exact opposite of what Jean Genet was doing, actually. So I see it as a sort of shift, if you will, a sort of paradigm shift in the French letters.
But it's interesting because it seems to me like it has to do with the hagiographizing of Genet by actual moral thinkers, right? So Genet, it was, you know, writing as a madman in a way, and needs to be taken literally in that sense that evil is something playful and wonderful to Genet, and yet the other person then takes that as a trope and uses it for an actual moral system. Is that?
Yeah, this is a big misreading of Jean Genet. It's a misreading that has been effected by scholars, admirable scholars like Edouard Said, for example, who imagined that Jean Genet was siding with the Palestinians because he identified with the good guy, with the oppressed. But if you read Genet well and rigorously, you will see that it's the exact opposite. And others have made the same type of mistake. Fortunately, Yvan Jablonka, much more recently, has written an extraordinary intellectual and sociological biography of Jean Genet. It's entitled The Unavoidable Truths of Jean Genet, in which he establishes lots of, in which he compensates for lots of false ideas about romanticizing or hagiographizing, as you call it, Jean Genet.
Yeah, to make up that word. I think one of the things that I find really interesting is that nevertheless, people are able to take the vocabulary from people like Genet and Bataille and Margaret Duras, who you also mentioned in the book, and they take that vocabulary and use it for this new moralistic turn, but they're still using those words like evil and transgression in a kind of double irony, maybe. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the language and how Bashi, for example, uses it in his novel. Or maybe you could tell us actually about the publication of Moi, Mohamed Mera, which was a big event, I think.
Yeah, so I make a distinction, I hope clear enough in my book, between, how to put it, between a conjunctural or a circumstantial intervention by Salim Bashi in the immediate aftermath of the Toulouse massacre of Jewish children by jihadists in the city of Toulouse. It's 2012, right? And so Salim Bashi was invited by the newspaper Le Monde, the daily Le Monde, to write a piece about this event. It was very distasteful because he was invited like one day after this terrible massacre. And so he writes a piece entitled Moi, Mohamed Mera, which is I, Mohamed Mera, in which he puts himself in the mind of the terrorist whose name was Mohamed Mera. And he... throughout this very short piece, it's in your newspaper, right? So throughout this very short piece of quasi-fiction, if you will, quasi-fiction, quasi-journalistic commentary, quasi-op-ed, if you will, he says that there is that basically the murder of those Jewish children is a retribution or a retribution for Palestinian death and a retribution for the discrimination against young Muslims in France and a way of taking revenge against the French Republic, which alienates and discriminates against the young Muslims. So I found this a very disingenuous trick, if you will, and I contrasted with much, much more intelligent, much more complex and nuanced novels that he writes, which I analyze in depth, in details in my book, in which it's much more complicated to come up with a sort of ultimate signified and to an ultimate meaning. But in this very short piece in the newspaper, it is clear that there is a sort of moralistic turn, and the transgression, the evil, the nihilism become something of a struggle against a form of state oppression and racism and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm, right. So the transgressor, so in kind of imagining the worldview of the transgressor and making the transgressor the main subject, which is something that the older theorists did, here kind of borrowing that structure, he in a sense erases the actual victims. Would you agree?
Oh, completely, and the absolutely, and it's all the more distasteful that it takes place, you know, really at a sort of competition between the novelist and the news, right? so there is an aspect of haste, an aspect of speed, which I find very problematic. You need time in order to process. And you need a novel, you need literature, actually, in order to process events of that negative magnitude.
So I take it there are other parts of the kind of fundamental or pervasive ethics of late modernism, postmodernism, post-postmodernism that we can see in a lot of these authors that you mentioned. Some of those are a kind of ethic of nomadism, of marginality, and we find those ideas in theorists like Levinas and Blanchot, and then we see them again in many, like kind of reversed and turned around in many different places. But to begin with, why are these such appealing ideas? Why is it such an appealing thing to make the kind of ethical subject of late post and postmodernism the nomad?
Well, nomadism is a trope of freedom. it is a trope also of I would say victimization. And so there is this idea that the nomad is the minority, is a minority figure, right? It's a figure who belongs to the oppressed group. So what's interesting is that someone like Jean Genet was into a celebration of exile and nomadism, but then again, for him, like for Guattari and Deleuze, this nomadism was always antinomian and profoundly immoral, in the same way as Deleuze and Guattari a concept of deterritorialization and nomadism. But I see again a shift here with the new trend of engaging with Jewish diasporism. So if you think about, for example, Judith Butler, who has written several years ago this book entitled Parting Ways, and it's Jewishness as a Critique of Zionism, if you look at her take on diasporism, and Jewish diasporism, then what you have is a nomadism, but which is repatriated into moralism, I would put it this way. You know, diasporism, you have, of course, a long time ago, you have Sartre, who in Being and Nothingness equated the diasporic Jew and the consciousness of the for itself. Diasporism was already, for Sartre, a metaphor for emancipation, a metaphor for freedom, emancipation from all kinds of determinations. Now, you could argue that of course, that Levinas' diasporism and his nomadism were, to an extent, also moralistic, although, of course, I would not use moralism for Levinas because his ethics is so radical that moralism doesn't work. But Levinas, however, always recognized the tragic condition of the human being. He recognized that there is ethics and that there is politics and there is justice and the need to make some choices between different evils, between choices that are always impossible. And this tragic condition, that is the history, what I call history itself, is completely rejected by Judith Butler, in my opinion. That's what I argue in my book. And the reason why she does not support the idea of a finite, limited, bordered, if you will, Jewish existence in a Jewish state is precisely because I think she does not recognize this limited and finite human condition, which Levinas did actually acknowledge. So I take issue with Butler diasporism, but I take many issue with her misreading, which I find extremely troubling, her misreading of Levinas and her distortion of Levinas.
Mm-hmm. Like, it seems to me that it relates a little bit to this idea that Jews are acceptable and even admirable as the Jew of the spirit. So as long as the Jew stands for the nomad, the alien, the person in exile, and that means having that perfect autonomy, and the Jew has to kind of stand for that, and the Jew becomes mainly a trope and therefore not a person or a community in Butler.
Well, there is a form of dehistoricizing, that's for sure, also of a form of disincarnation, which again, to go back to Jean-François Lyotard, Jews, he has got in lots of trouble because he put Jews into quotation marks and so on, or scare quotes, but his Jews were actually very, very incarnate or very embodied, very much in the flesh. He understood this dimension of incarnation of flesh for Judaism, which is something that I think Judith Butler has a hard time engaging with. It's a very important part of Jewish facticity or factualness.
I think to me it seems to go back to a fundamental modernist ideal of everybody being disincarnated, everybody being no longer attached to their commitments, which were actual complicities in power structures. And everybody has to kind of find themselves as self-fashioning agents rather than as part of structures which have been coercive and oppressive. And so then the Jew becomes a kind of paradigm of that in Butler. Is that right? Like when she tries to say, tries to kind of build a picture of the ideal Jew.
Well, yes, that is true. It would be, you know, it's not a work that I've done because I don't think I'm competent to do this. But I do think that there would be something interesting to do between her take on let's say Jewish ontology and gender theory or deconstruction of gender or undoing gender. I think it would be very interesting because in both cases you have the Jew who escapes, as you said, sort of natural social historic determinations, and you have a subject who is free in gender performance, is free to invent himself or herself into another gender. So I think that it would be very interesting to make this comparison. I've not made it, but it would be certainly. But you know, there is also.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to read anything into you that you haven't said. So yeah. But what I do find interesting is your point about the tragic condition of humanity, and that's been a basis for ethics for other writers such as Kierkegaard, and you also read that into literature. It's interesting that you say that Bashi's novels seem to be somewhat successful in the illustration of the tragic condition And one of the other things that you comment about writers such as Bataille and Janet, to go back to that, is that that they, to quote you, are awkwardly yet genuinely acknowledge the common inhumanity. So it's not just our common humanity that we need to acknowledge and that we talk a lot about, but we also need to acknowledge our common inhumanity.
Yes. So, you know, if we deem or if we consider that evil and barbarity are inherent part of the human condition, and I do believe that, then we maybe we'll stop demonizing the other. You know, maybe we'll stop projecting our own inhumanity onto the other. And I would even argue, I don't want to play the philosophers here, but I would be tempted to argue that all the evil of history comes from this projection, the Jew as the inhuman, the non-Christian as the inhuman, the Greek, the barbarian for the Greek is the inhuman, for the communist revolution, the bourgeois must be eradicated and then humanity will be free, liberated and redeemed. So any kind of, how to put it, any kind of, I'm looking for the word, soteriology, you know, salvation type of discourse, whether it's religious or secular, atheistic, is very dangerous in my opinion. It's always a logic of purification. It's always a fantasy of establishing a sort of unlimited empire of the good, so to speak. And this is why I identify myself as part of what philosopher Régis Debray has called the tragic left, and he opposes it to the divine left. Tragic left means that we recognize that there will never be any kind of end to history, and that we live in this tragic, limited, historical, and finite condition. So this is my position, and I really have the impression that thinkers like the new radicality, if you will, like Judith Butler, Alain Badiou, and others have a tendency to fantasize that sort of messianic moment, or what I call soteriological moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that kind of helps me to understand something that seems like a mystery to me, Bataille's early anti-fascism. And I say that because Bataille is kind of a consummate amoralist, and yet in 1933, when many other people were kind of hiding their heads, he was aggressively anti-fascist and publicly anti-fascist, and it seems like a contradiction. But on the other hand, he's pulling in this idea of evil and transgression in a way that is actually that tragic orientation to the world. Okay, we're going to acknowledge it.
By definition for Bataille, there is no faith in a kind of redemption. There is no faith in some sort of moment that will, in which humanity will have been purified for all kind of negativity. And whether we like it or not, we have to admit that Nazism, along with communism, were ideologies and politics of purification. You know, the idea of purity is completely alien to Georges Bataille. He didn't believe for one second, you know, that there would be such a moment of purity or purification. So I think Bataille is parting ways, and it's being, of course, virulently anti-fascist for this reason in particular. He cannot recognize himself in any kind of discourse, any kind of ideology of purity or purification.
Yeah, so it's interesting that literature came up at a certain time, and even Janet were kind of acknowledging and interested in evil, but then it becomes the same vocabulary turns into a purifying motif. It becomes, so we then again, we kind of incorporate evil, but then we again project that evil outwards onto the other in outrage, as, you know, Hessel seems to be doing.
No, absolutely. This is why I recommend reading Robert Antelme. I don't know if you're familiar with the major testimony by Robert Antelme entitled The Human Race in English. It's L'Espèce Humaine in French, so it's not exactly race in French, it's the species. And in that book, published for the first time in 1947, Robert Antelme effect something really fascinating. He just back from Gandersham and Buchenwald and Dachau. He's a survivor. He was not a Jewish deportee, but he was a resistant communist. And so he comes back and he writes this book, The Human Species. And he says there is no inherent difference. There is no ontological difference between the SS and the victim of the SS. And there is a moment where, you know, when Robert Antelme says we have to integrate within us this part of evil. And it's not by chance that Robert Antelme was the husband of Marguerite Duras, because they shared the same philosophy, you know, that this part of evil, this part of the inhuman has to be integrated within the human. And this is, you know, I always teach actually Robert Antelme to my students when I teach a course on post-Holocaust France and testimony, because this is one of the most important book, not only of testimony and of history, but also of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. So you also write about how Arendt and others might have been read or misread on the banality of evil, and how there's a kind of strange turning back around and around about of kind of viewing that extreme as ordinary. The Nazi is just like us, versus, you know, seeing now the ordinary as extreme. Everything that we do in complicity with kind of with the structures and of society might be violence.
I think what is very troubling is the development in what I call radical epistemology. In particular, I'm taking the example of Giorgio Agamben and his tendency to, Nazify modernity and liberal democracy. You know, if everything is read through the prism of Nazism, in other words, if everything is reduced to the extreme case, then it's very hard to recognize, remember, think, reflect about the singularity that the Nazi period represents in history. And this is one problem that I see in what I call radical epistemology. You see the same epistemological move in all the radical thinkers, right-wing or left-wing. You know, you see in Carl Schmitt, for example, I think I mentioned Carl Schmitt in my book, you have this idea that to define the political, you have to see the extreme case, and the extreme case is a state of emergency, war, and state of exception, and therefore the political and the essence of the political is a distinction between friend and enemy. I think it's a very problematic, very especially from Carl Schmitt, who was a legal philosopher and Nazi himself. I think it's very problematic to reduce, if you will, the political to this distinction, friend and enemy. So, you know, I see the exact same tendency in thinkers like Giorgio Agamben, what I call the sort of reductio to the extreme case, and the normalization of the extreme case.
Mm-hmm. So, if I can just take you back to your process. You had mentioned in the early part of your book that this book took you many years and several attempts to write. And I'm wondering why was it such a hard thing to write?
Well, at first it was, it was a very personal endeavor. I followed with lots of angst the events of the early millennium in France in particular. I was already mentioning the attacks on Jews, the attacks on the synagogues during the Second Intifada. Then, of course, it's very difficult to compete with current events as history unfolds. So there is a huge challenge of working on the extreme contemporary material, especially material which is at once literary, cultural, and even pop
popular culture since I examined, as you recall, the case of the stand-up comedian anti-Semite Dieudonné in my book. So I had to take out this book out of my system, as you say in English. And sorry for the cliche, but I had to turn a page in my life. So finishing this book was a part of this urge. So of course it all began with a sort of personal affect. I would say like any intellectual or artistic or scholarly project, but hopefully the affect can be shared in a rational language and reach out to some readers.
Mm-hmm. You write also that you regarding Geoffrey Melman, that his spirit of irony and his love-hate relationship with French thought is an ambivalence that you may very well share. So do you still feel ambivalent about French thought? Is there some what is left in theory that could be a tool that could address the problems that you've identified?
Well, there are lots of things which are left in French thought. it's not from dead, although there is a tendency now in French studies to think that the Italian theory is competing with French philosophy. I would disagree with that. Now, there are some tools that we can go back to Levinas, of course. There are still tools in Maurice Blanchot, perhaps in more marginal text. I was mentioning earlier the way Blanchot had, with an incredible prophetic moment, an incredible lucidity, had denounced anti-Semitism without anti-Semites. And I think we should meditate on that. There are also tools in post-structuralist contemporary theory. No need to go back to the 60s and 70s. I'm thinking of Eric Marty, who was a disciple of Roland Barthes and Louis Althusser. I'm thinking also of Shmuel Trigano, the anthropologist of religion, and also of the Lacanian linguist Jean-Claude Milner. I don't think that theory is dead. French thought is not dead, but I warn, however, against a certain hubris and a certain tendency to generalize, to conceptualize, and to erase the singularities and to reduce all the tensions, something that fortunately the literature doesn't do. That's why actually I have focused at certain moments in the book on some literary texts, such as Salim Bashi, but also on Philip Roth, for example.
Yeah, we didn't have a chance to talk about how literature works, both as the Jew as a figure of literature and as a literature as the way kind of to reach this tragic point of this tragic leftism that you seem to kind of.
Well, it all starts with 1968 again with the book by Patrick Modiano, who won a Nobel Prize recently for all his work. But he started his literary work in a career in 1968 with a book called La Place de l'Étoile, The Place of the Star. It's the square of the star. It's impossible to translate into English. It's a very bizarre carousel or sort of a puzzle or sort of kaleidoscope of the impossible of being Jewish after the war and after the foundation of Israel. I see, in the Philip Roth Operation Shylock, something which is much more successful than Patrick Modiano when he was very young and was 20 years old when he wrote that book, but a much more successful attempt at showing, at illustrating, at all the tensions within Jewish being and Jewish identity. It's the trauma of post-war Jewish being, assimilation or no assimilation, Israel or no Israel, repatriation into the diaspora or staying in Israel. So all of those questions are posed with an incredible sense of humor and irony in Philip Roth. There is also, protagonists who are absolutely hilarious, like the Zionist protagonist, the diasporist, Moshe Pipik, the Holocaust denier, the Arab intellectual, the Jew who is obsessed with anti-Semitism, and all those things. So, in a way, I would say that literature is much superior to philosophy in general to think about Jewish something as complicated as nuanced and as subtle as a Jewish singularity or particularity.
Yeah. I actually haven't read the book, but I got very clearly the sense that you have all these characters who we can relate to with sympathy and empathy, but we can also feel disgusted by, and we can also feel outrage about. And it's all, you know, none of that can really be separated out. And that's what only literature can do, I suppose. I know that in the book, you say you're a little bit polemical. And in conversation, you've told me, you know, you feel the book has been a little bit polemical. And I wonder what reviews and reactions you've heard, and if there's anything in the book that you would want to reconsider, given some of the reactions that you've maybe received.
No, I don't think I would rewrite things differently, despite, of course, the change and the new situation with the return of a populist type, more traditional, if you will, type of anti-Semitism. You know, I've received some reviews. One reviewer called me too liberal in the Jewish Review of Books. And I was called in another review pretty much an Islamophobe. So I don't exactly know what to make out of it. Fortunately, I had also very measured and very fair reviews by scholars, French scholars such as Jerry Prince and the French essayist Maxime Ducoux. And I hope other will come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read one review by Brett Ashley Kaplan. I think it was in the H French listserv. And it was interesting because he's very, very respectful. His tone is quite classy. And he says, you know, he really respects you as a scholar, but he basically disagrees with everything you say. And one of the things he said was that that theory overlaps so much with Jewish thought that it would seem highly counterintuitive to claim that theory is somehow anti-Semitic. So what's your thought?
Yeah, that's a misreading of the book. I don't think at one moment in the book I call theory anti-Semitic. Far from it. So I think Kaplan doesn't have a real mastery of hermeneutic rigor. When I accuse a theorist such as Vattimo, the Italian Gianni Vattimo, the Italian philosopher, of Talmud bashing and conspiracy theory, it is based on textual evidence. There is just no way that it can be denied, because I base this accusation, I don't like the word, but you understand what I'm trying to say, on a textual evidence. When I accuse Judith Butler of Levinas bashing, it is also, or distortion, it's also based on textual evidence. So, you know, she Kaplan cannot have read in my book that Lyotard, Derrida, Blanchot, Traverso are anti-Semitic, because I never say that. No, the real problem is that postmodern philosemitism does not give us the tools to respond to the new challenges of anti-Semitism. This is the main central argument of the book. But never, never at any moment an indictment of French thought or postmodern theory. Yes, an indictment of distortions and indictment of particularly of Gianni Vattimo for, in fact, real anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think one of the real advantages of your book is that you really shy away from generalizations. But it's interesting because your title, for those who don't get the irony of the title, it kind of allows for them to say, I think he might have said that, oh, you know, Shawat certainly answers the question, is theory good for the Jews? And thinks, no, theory is not good for the Jews. Whereas I think it's very clear because of the way that you really respond only very specifically with specific examples and analyses of certain authors.
And I remind the reader that I'm a theory addict, and I remain a theory addict, and I continue to like reading conceptual discourse and philosophical discourse. And I mentioned in the beginning of the interview several remarkable efforts from, what we call theorists, like Jean-Luc Nancy and Jean-Michel Salansky. The philosopher Jean-Michel Salansky recently wrote an extraordinary book entitled The Jewish Fact, or Le Fait Juif, which unfortunately doesn't exist in English. So there are lots of new attempts at, at thinking theoretically about this problem.
Yeah, and there's a certain humor in your title and in certain areas of your book that, you know, that people have to be able to be interested in taking up, that there's a sense of humor going on. And it's interesting that at the end of your book, you have this little excursus about the role of humor in theory and in ethics, I guess.
You know, I've got the impression that lots of theorists that I engage with, I'm not talking of Lyotard again or even Derrida, but lots of theorists, and here I'm thinking in particular perhaps of Traverso, I'm thinking of Judith Butler, really lack a sense of humor. And I've been trying as much as possible. I don't try because it's natural to me to laugh, you know, at things. And I engage with Dieudonné, who is a humorist, anti-Semitic one, but also a funny one, actually. And we have to recognize this extreme ambiguity again of a man who happens to be anti-Semitic, but who can also at other moments be extremely funny. So I think that witticism and humor are extremely important. Perhaps it's a Jewish thing. I don't know.
Perhaps. We're running out of time, unfortunately, but I had wanted to ask you about your next work. I know that you're doing something about Gnosticism, and you even drop hints in this book about Gnosticism. And I wonder if you can, on one leg, tell us, how does Gnosticism relate to modern French theory? Is it a continuation?
So let me tell you a quick story. Several years ago, when I was at the dentist's office, I was reading People magazine, which I do when I go to the dentist, and there was an interview with Kathleen Jenner, formerly known as Bruce Jenner, right? So Kathleen Jenner was interviewed about her transition from male to female, and I was struck that by her rhetoric, that was the rhetoric of a successful quest toward the true, the authentic self. It was a rhetoric of liberation, if you will. And I figured out this quest is very old. It's ancient, goes back to the ancient Gnostics. So I immediately was struck and very intrigued by the rhetoric of gender theory and that of the ancient Gnostic, which is a rhetoric of self-realization, the idea that the true self must be found before creation. One is created male or female, but it does not really matter. What matters is to find one's true self. So there is a sort of war against creation, against natural and social determinations that you can find also in existentialism, so early 20th century, as well as in ancient Gnosticism. Hence, my interest in looking at French modern literature and thought from the, and it includes also American gender theory, I mentioned Judith Butler, through this prism of the search for escaping the world and creation. So that's the sort of Gnostic reading of the long 20th century, particularly France. So I go back to the interwar period up to the present, contemporary with Michel Houellebecq and authors such as Volodine, for example.
Okay, that's something that we can look forward to reading about, I guess, when you get that book done. We'll hopefully have you on again. Thank you so much for being here, Bruno.
Davida, thank you very much.
Thank you. So we've been talking to Bruno Chaouat, professor of French at the University of Minnesota.